Chapter 22, Realm Distinction. We've been tracking the story of Yahweh and his portion, Abraham's descendants. Yahweh chose to disinherit the nations at Babel. He chose to appear to Abraham in visible human form to initiate a covenant relationship. He chose to reiterate that covenant with Isaac and Jacob, whom he renamed Israel. And he chose to deliver Israel from Egypt. These choices telegraph theological messages. Israel existed because Yahweh had supernaturally enabled the birth of Isaac. They continue to exist because Yahweh wanted a people on earth by his own plan and by his own power. The lesser Elohim he had placed over the disinherited nations, particularly those in Egypt at this point of the story, cannot prevent his will. There is no God like Yahweh. His goal of making the earth a new Eden will not be overturned. Before the plagues and the exodus from Egypt, the descendants of Jacob knew Yahweh only by reputation and oral storytelling. Now they were at his mountain, ready to journey to the land he had taken for himself, and for them, they had the tablets of the law, but that was just a starting point. Egypt and her gods had been defeated, but the conflict with the gods and their nations was just beginning. Israel needed to understand that being Yahweh's portion meant separation from the gods and the nations who stood ready to oppose them. The concept of realm distinctions was fundamental to the supernatural worldview of ancient Israel. Holiness and sacred space. Yahweh is an Elohim, not a mortal man. Appearing as a human being was a condescension that enabled the lesser minds of mortals to comprehend his presence and live to tell about it. Yahweh is so other as to be incomprehensible, without the facade of something familiar. And yet for Israel, his otherness would need to remain an ever-present reality sensed at all times. The concept of otherness was at the core of Israelite identity. Otherness is the core of holiness. The Hebrew vocabulary for holiness means to be set apart or to be distinct. While the idea has a moral dimension related to conduct, it is not intrinsically about morality. It is about distinction. Israel's identification with Yahweh by virtue of his covenant with Abraham and the terms of the covenant at Sinai meant that, as Leviticus 19:2 concisely summarizes, Israelites were to be set apart, holy, as Yahweh was set apart, holy. Yahweh's complete otherness was reinforced in the minds of Israelites through worship and sacrifice. Yahweh was not only the source of Israel's life, he was life. Yahweh was complete in his perfections. Yahweh was not of earth, a place where there is death, disease, and imperfection. His realm is supernatural, ours is terrestrial. The space he occupies is sacred and made otherworldly by his presence. The space we occupy is profane or ordinary. Yahweh is the antithesis of ordinary. Humans must be invited and purified to occupy the same space. Many laws in the Torah illustrate this worldview and its messaging. Whether priest or not, male or female, people could be disqualified from sacred space by a variety of activities and conditions. Examples include sexual activity, bodily emissions, physical handicaps, contact with a dead body, and childbirth. The logic of such exclusions is simple, yet foreign to our modern clinical minds. Sexual intercourse, emissions of sexual fluids, uterine discharges, and menstruation were not considered unclean out of prudishness. Rather, the concept was that the body had lost the fluids that contain, create, and sustain life. That which is not whole and is associated with loss of life, cannot enter Yahweh's presence until a ritual restoration rectified that status. The same reasoning is behind the ritually unclean status of those with physical handicaps, infected with the disease, and who have touched a corpse, animal or human. Yahweh's presence meant life and perfection, not death and defectiveness. These laws kept the community conscious of Yahweh's otherness. Regulations governing the sanctity of Yahweh's dwelling provided concrete object lessons about the realm distinction. The ground that dwelling encompassed was sacred space in relationship to the people of Israel. The separateness of the divine realm was reinforced by the laws that allowed or disallowed proximity to Yahweh. These permissions or prohibitions even extended to inanimate objects associated with Yahweh and his service. Even within sacred space, there were gradations of holiness or sanctity. The closer one got to Yahweh's presence, the more holy the ground or the objects in its proximity. The terms that describe the layout of the structure are evidence of this progression. From the entrance inward, there was the court, the holy place, and the most holy place, or holy of holies. The sacred space of the tabernacles got progressively more holy from the entrance to the innermost room. The progressive holiness zones were also distinguished by the priestly clothing associated with them, Exodus 28:29. For example, the high priest, the person with permitted access to the holiest place, wore a unique ephod, breastplate, and headdress inscribed with "Holy to Yahweh." The holier the zone, the more costly the animal sacrificed to sanctify the priest when they entered into the presence of Yahweh for rituals. Leviticus 8. The tabernacle, heaven on earth. That Yahweh dwelled in a tent before the construction of the temple, much later during the time of Solomon, is important for marking sacred space. The tabernacle, Hebrew Mishkan, or dwelling, was the place where Yahweh would cause his name, his presence, to dwell. As a divine abode, the tabernacle was also analogous to Eden. Like Eden, the tabernacle was cosmic in conception, the place where heaven and earth met, a veritable microcosm of the Edenic creation where God first dwelt on earth. There are many subtle connections between Eden and the tabernacle, some of them discernible only in Hebrew text. For our purposes, several of the more obvious are worth noting. To begin, the description of the tabernacle as a tent dwelling is significant. Elsewhere in the biblical world, deities and their councils were considered to live in tents, atop their cosmic mountains and in their lush gardens. The tent of the god, or gods, was, as with mountain or lush gardens, the place where heaven and earth intersected and where divine decrees were issued. This was a common cultural idea, perhaps akin to how many people think of church. Church is a place you'd expect to meet God, or where God can be found. Moses was told to construct the tabernacle and its equipment according to the pattern shown to him by Yahweh on the holy mountain, in Exodus 25:9, 40, 26, and 30. The implication is that the tabernacle on earth was to be a copy of the heavenly tent, in accord with the religious principle of as in heaven, so on earth. The heavenly tent prototype was the heavens themselves. As Isaiah 40:22 tells us, "It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in." This kind of language is also why the earth is referred to as God's footstool. Yahweh sits above the circle of the earth in his heavenly tent, on his throne above the waters which are above the firmament, and rests his feet on the earth, which is his footstool, Job 9:8 and Psalms 104:2. As Eden was the place where humanity experienced the presence of God, so too was the tabernacle. This was particularly true for the priest, but God's presence occasionally met Israel's leaders outside of the Holy of Holies. Leviticus 9:23, Numbers 12:5-19, 20:6, and Deuteronomy 31:15. The most obvious instance being the glory cloud, Exodus 40, verses 34, 35. The menorah, lampstand, in the tabernacle is a striking analogy with the tree of life in Eden. The lampstand was fashioned in the appearance of a tree, Exodus 25, 31 through 36, and was stationed directly outside the Holy of Holies. The cherubim inside the Holy of Holies are also a clear connection to Eden. The Edenic cherubim stood guard at the dwelling place of God in Eden. Their position atop the lid to the Ark of the Covenant is not coincidental. The innermost sanctum of the tabernacle was the place from which God would govern Israel. The cherubim form a throne for the invisible Yahweh. Later, when the tent of the most holy place was moved to the temple, two giant cherubim were installed within for Yahweh's throne, making the ark his footstool. Well, lastly, as Beale notes, the entrance to Eden was from the east, Genesis 3:24, which was also the direction from which one entered the tabernacle, and later the temples of Israel. Genesis 2:12 says that good gold and bdellium and onyx stone were in the land of Havilah, apparently where Eden was. Of course, various items of tabernacle furniture were made of gold, as were the walls, ceiling, and floor of the Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple, 1 Kings 6, verses 20 through 22. Sacrifice and Israel's cosmic geography. One Israelite ritual in particular illustrates realm distinction. In the context of Deuteronomy 32 worldview, which has the nations under the dominion of lesser gods, the entire Israelite camp was cosmic geography and sacred space. Israel was identified with Yahweh, both the people and the land that Yahweh had determined would belong to the descendants of Abraham, were Yahweh's portion. Deuteronomy 4, 19 through 20, 32, 8 and 9. The Day of Atonement ritual, Leviticus 16, provides a fascinating convergence of these ideas. Part of that ritual's description goes like this. And Aaron shall take the two goats, and he shall present them before Yahweh at the tent of the assembly's entrance. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for Yahweh and one for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goats on which the lot for Yahweh fell, and he shall sacrifice it as a sin offering. But he must present alive before Yahweh the goat on which the lot for Azazel fell to make atonement for himself, to send it away into the desert to Azazel. And why is one of the goats for Azazel? Who or what is Azazel? The passage is inexplicable unless you're acquainted with the cosmic geographical ideas we've been talking about. The word Azazel in Hebrew text can be translated the goat that goes away. This is the justification for the common scapegoat translation in some English versions. The scapegoat, so the translator has it, symbolically carries the sin of the people away from the camp of Israel into the wilderness. Seems simple enough. However, Azazel is really a proper name. In Leviticus 16:8, one goat is for Yahweh, while the other goat is for Azazel. Since Yahweh is a proper name, and the goats are described in this way, Hebrew parallelism informs us that Azazel is also a proper name. What needs resolution is what it means. Azazel is regarded as the name of a demon in the Dead Sea Scrolls and other ancient Jewish books. In fact, one scroll, 4Q 180:1-8, Azazel is the leader of the angels that sinned in Genesis 6:1-4. The same descriptions appears in the book of 1 Enoch, 8:1-6, 10:4-8, 13:1, 54:5-6, 55:4, and 69:2. Recall that intertestamental Judaism, the offending sons of God from Genesis 6, were believed to have been imprisoned in a pit or abyss in the netherworld. Azazel's realm was somewhere out in the desert, outside the confines of holy ground. It was a place associated with supernatural evil. The Old Testament itself does not state that Azazel was a demon. Scholars have, however, connected the name to Mot, the god of death. The identification of the term with a demon may also derive from cosmic geography and an association of the wilderness with the forces of chaos which are hostile to God. This would make sense on several levels, as the desert would not only be a place forbidding to life, but as the ground outside the camp of Israel and Yahweh, the source of life, would have a clear association with chaos. Leviticus 17:7 suggests that Israelites saw the desert as spiritually sinister. So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifice to goat demons, after whom they whore. We are not told why they did this, but the placement of this problem in proximity to the ritual goat to Azazel suggests a conceptual connection. Jews of later periods certainly made such connections. In the Day of Atonement ritual, the goat for Yahweh, the goat that was sacrificed, purges the impurities caused by the people of Israel and purifies the sanctuary. The goat for Azazel was sent away after the sins of the Israelites were symbolically placed on it. The point of the goat for Azazel was not that something was owed to the demonic realm, as though a ransom was being paid. The goat for Azazel banished the sins of the Israelites to the realm outside Israel. Why? Because the ground on which Yahweh had his dwelling was holy. Sin had to be transported to where evil belonged, the territory outside Israel, under the control of God set over the pagan nations. The high priest was not sacrificing to Azazel. Rather, Azazel was getting what belonged to him, sin. The concept of realm distinction and cosmic geography go hand in hand. Every day, ancient Israel's journey to the Promised Land reiterated some point in regard to who they were and their purpose on earth. The invisible Yahweh and the visible Yahweh were present as cloud and angel, leading his people through the domain of hostile gods and their people to Israel's own divinely allotted home. When they were camped, the glow of Yahweh's fire over the tabernacle, Eden, returned to earth, illuminated the camp. They were Yahweh's portion. The forces of chaos, seen and unseen, were on every border. One would think the living object lessons would have ensured faith when it came time to confront those forces, but that wasn't to be.